what closes these gaps? What can policymakers do? That's the million-dollar question we're all kind of after in this literature.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Whether you're talking about the inequality of income or consumption or any of the other ways to measure inequality, about half of that inequality in a developing world is accounted for by whether people live in or out of a city. So how should we measure this urban-rural gap, and what should policymakers do about it? Well, if anything. A new paper by David Lagarkas of Boston University carefully picks apart these difficult but very important questions. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Why do the urban-rural differences in developing countries deserve our attention?
Yeah, I mean, that's the right question. They're really big, and they're within a country where there's no formal borders. You know, it's not like the U.S.-Mexico border where it's a huge political issue and there's restrictions. You know, nobody outside of China is restricted from moving from their village to the nearby town or city. And yet there's these huge gaps in living standards. There's this possibility that there's a way to get people out of poverty and raise average income levels by getting people to cities. And that's kind of, I think, related to one of the old ideas in development economics about a dual economy, where there's a modern sector where everything's looks like London or New York or Boston. And then there's a traditional economy where people grow food in the backyard and eat it. And the urban-rural gap is one of the most tangible ways you can see that modern and traditional divide in the data.
Your paper kicks off by explaining some of those practical differences in day-to-day life. You picked Nigeria and India as examples. Differences between urban and rural locations. Can you give me some examples of that?
I picked those two because Nigeria is the biggest country in Africa. India, of course, is the world's biggest developing country. So start off with what happens when you're an infant or child. Under five mortality is one of these statistics. Hard to argue with that. Lower under five mortality has been one of the big successes in the last century all around the world. But there's still this big urban-rural gap. And so in the paper, I cite some statistics from the demographic and health surveys. You know, you're about half as likely to die before the age of five in a city as in a village in India and in Nigeria. And I believe that statistics like that would be true if you looked in other African countries. So that's like non-economists will say, well, you know, they're poor in those villages, but they're happy, aren't they? Some of them are, I'm sure, but nobody wants their children to perish. So that's just such a tangible measure of the gap. That's probably the most important one. You know, you look at what happens when you're a young person, you should be in school. You know, in Nigeria, you're about half as likely to be in school when you're below the age of 18 in a village as in a city. India is closer to parity, but there's huge quality gaps, which are clearly related to urban versus rural. My former colleague, Kartik Muralidharan, teaches this economics of education class. And one lecture, he'll just walk in and start lecturing in Hindi. Of course, the students don't understand it, but why does he do it? He wants to show you in India, some huge fraction of the kids have a teacher that doesn't speak a language they can understand. There's also the issue of teacher absence, which is bigger in rural areas. You're not going to learn from a teacher if the teacher is not there. So even if the kids are in school in rural areas, you know, the quality issues are really huge. You're getting a less education. In adulthood, there's just huge disparities in rural-urban gaps. Tangible things like the house that you live in, you'd be very unlikely to have a wood floor or a slate floor, some other kind of rock, you know, stone floor. You probably have a dirt floor in a village. In a city, you could have a dirt floor, of course, but you'd be more likely to have a finished floor. And so on and so forth for walls and roofs and everything. There's measures of whether you have extremely low body mass indices, and those are also worse in rural areas. So I like these statistics because they're really tangible. The issue is you can't aggregate them really very easily, but they're just so concrete and pointing to these rural urban gaps.
As economists, we always have to try and put numbers on these inequalities, don't we? It's not always so easy, is it?
It's not. I was going to ask you, have you had Alwyn Young to do a podcast yet?
No, I haven't.
Alwyn's done a lot of work trying to think about how you aggregate them. He has a paper talking about Africa's growth, where he aggregates these measures. He does the same kind of aggregation looking at the cross sections. It's not real transparent what he does. He could explain better than anyone else what he actually does. Wages are a good measure to look at. You know, what's the problem with wages, though? Most people don't actually work for a wage, and certainly in a rural area, but even in cities, most non-agriculture workers are self-employed in Africa and most of the South Asia. So yeah, it's not easy to aggregate the statistics like the ones I just said. And then you get these nice aggregate things like average wages, but they don't apply to most of the population. Anywhere you measure it is going to be flawed in some way or another. Alwyn's way may be the best, I don't know, but I've read his paper many times. And I still couldn't tell you, honestly, I know exactly what he did in his aggregation.
The standard way, though, to compare income or consumption is if you use a price deflator for a similar basket of goods. I mean, everyone's taught to do that at university when we compare living standards between countries. If we did this in an urban-rural comparison, what can we learn, what can't we learn?
You're right, that's the standard way. There's a lot of work that's been done on that. Martin Revelyan and co-authors have done a lot of work. Many others have. It's hard to get a basket. The fictionalized ideal that you teach undergraduate is there's this basket, the same basket. For food, you can do a pretty good job. You can find tubers and vegetables and grains and whatever it is people are eating, and you can compare that. And I think the conclusion that people have drawn is that that's about 30% more expensive in cities than in rural areas, broadly defined. So what do you learn from that? You learn that that's not really enough to close the gap, even for a low-skilled worker. So even somebody who never finished primary school, which should be, you know, most workers in Africa, that 30% gap would not be enough to offset the higher wages you'd get in a city. The rest of it is harder. Food may be a big fraction of your basket. It may be 70%, 80%. Housing, I mean, go to a rural village and find some housing structures, some modest home, and say, I'm going to get the price of the same thing in the city. It just doesn't exist. There's amenities that you have in the city that you don't have in the village. So it's really, really hard to compare prices of stuff other than food. And there's heroic efforts to do that, like the International Comparison of Prices program that underlies the Penn World Tables. But there's comparison resistant services like housing and medical care that just, well, they resist comparison, basically. So it's real hard to get that exact basket. My takeaway is that where we can measure the basket, it's more expensive in the city, but not enough to make up for those wage and consumption gaps that we measure.
So if we think about the implications of this for policy and for policymakers, if they were just to focus on GDP growth and make a low-income country into a high-income country, does that solve this problem of urban-rural inequality?
Sort of. I'll give you an answer that I give my policy students, though, which is GDP growth isn't like a lever that somebody can pull. You know, imagine a policymaker sitting in their office. They say, oh, we got confused. We left the GDP growth lever low. Let's pull it to the right. There's specific policies that they can do. I don't know if they can control GDP directly. You know, they want to. That's an outcome that they're interested in affecting. So if you mean, can we focus on stimulating manufacturing? Will that take care of the problem? That will probably get urban areas to grow more. It'll probably get some people to move over. It's hard to see how that would close the gaps. The gaps haven't been closed now, and cities are richer. You could stimulate agriculture. You know, that's another kind of broad approach you could take. That, in principle, can raise living standards in rural areas, and that could help close the gap. I mean, I think there's some evidence that when you improve village life, you get migration to slow down. I'm not sure that you get gaps to close. It's a big issue. It's a question that I think is the right broad question to ask. I don't really think we know the answer, though. What closes these gaps? What can policymakers do? That's the million-dollar question we're all kind of after in this literature.
Absolutely. If we take a cross-section at the moment, do rich countries have less of an urban-rural gap than poor countries?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I can cite my own paper. We looked at something which wasn't quite a rural-urban gap. It was an agricultural productivity gap. The ratio of value added per worker in the non-agriculture sector, which would be largely urban, over the value added per worker in the agriculture sector, which would be largely rural. So that gap is bigger on average in the poorest countries in the world than the richest. So in that sense, the answer is yes. There's a lot of variation, though. If you look at those gaps in rich countries, there's some countries that have really huge gaps and others that have tiny ones. Same with poor countries. So I think the general answer is yes, but I don't think it's not as strong of a fact as I was thinking it would be.
One of the things we've mentioned already a couple of times is migration from rural to urban locations. For policymakers, there might not be any job to do if enough migration has already taken place so that the high productivity individuals are in urban locations and the low productivity individuals are still in rural locations. Then that would explain the inequality. How convincing is this explanation?
I think it's partially convincing. One of the things that I would say everybody has agreed on in this literature is that if you look at educated people, you know, people who finished secondary school, say, those are overwhelmingly likely to be located in cities. And so if you say, well, I'm going to take somebody who never finished primary school, I'm going to put them in a city and I'm going to expect them to earn the wages of somebody that went to college, that's clearly not going to happen. So there's clear sorting or selection, if you will, on education in cities. I think that's true everywhere you look. Even in today's rich countries, that's true. There's sorting on things other than education, and that's a tricky business. There's real clever people. The Lee et al. Paper that I cite in the piece, they have IQ measures, and they show that people who move to cities typically do better on various IQ measures. I think a lot of that is explaining these gaps, but I think there's a lot of stuff left to do. There's frictions that keep people from migrating. We can talk about some of those. But it just, if you step back for a second, the education sorting also suggests a role for policy. Go back to the thing I said about Kartik, you know, in the rural schools, not having the teachers be there and they speak a language the kids can't understand, etc. Fixing rural schools would give these people in rural areas opportunities to then be productive in cities. So that's not something you can fix overnight, but in the longer run, if you say, hey, well, cities are productive places only if you have education, giving people education will give them opportunities to be successful in cities.
Well, let's talk about those frictions. How much of the contribution to the gap between urban and rural can be explained by the migration that doesn't take place that would be beneficial if it did?
That's a great question. I wish I could tell you the exact number. I think it depends a lot country to country, but I think the general answer is that a lot of it is. Travis Bassler, he was, I'm going to say 2 years ago, he was in Kenya and he did these experiments where he provided information to a whole bunch of villagers about wages in Nairobi and other Kenyan cities and then the cost of living for a basket of food, just like you mentioned earlier. And he told them about what jobs people would get in these cities and how likely you were to get one of these jobs, being a rickshaw driver or a construction day laborer. And that information alone, they didn't give them money, they didn't give them anything else, just they gave them that message and they gave them a little flyer to hang on to. That, relative to a treatment group of other villagers, induced a whole lot of migration and higher wages. Travis looked at self-reported well-being, and that was higher. So for whatever reason, Travis has his stories based on incentives to hide information from your family and friends back in the village. But whatever the explanation, there's lots of potential room for just telling people about the actual conditions in the city, which, I don't know, early on in my career, I thought, how can people not know that? There must be some migrants coming back and forth. I think we're in an age where there's all sorts of information going around. Some of it's accurate, some of it's not. And there's probably lots of villagers who have really bad information about what's going on in the city. And that's a friction that may be expensive to fix that problem. It may be cheap. I don't think we know yet. But that's an example of a friction that I think is a big one. Another one that I think is really important is land markets, frictions, let's call them. Like, I have this meager inheritance in Greece, to tell a personal story. And Greece is in the EU. It's probably not considered a developing economy. It's like my grandfather's birth home. And since I'm the oldest male who actually wants this house, I'm trying to inherit it. And it's a nightmare. It's just like years and a lot of money. And I'm a rich person. So I'm this rich person with a lot of time and money. It's hard for me to get a title for that property in Greece. Imagine you're a villager in Africa. You've always been on this land. There's some local or tribal authority who, with words, knows that that's your land and the other villagers know that's your land. Imagine you want to sell part of that, cash in and start a new life in the city, buy a place or put down a rent payment, pay a year's rent on an apartment or something. Very, very hard to do that if you don't have a title to your land. And there's this paper I cite that's by Alan de Genvry and co-authors that looks at what happened in Mexico where they did land titling. And the answer is people who got titles were much more likely to migrate afterwards. And the story they put forward, which I think makes a lot of sense, is there's just so much uncertainty about whether you would actually have this land that if you left, you feel like you could lose it. So you don't leave. But then once you have a title, you say, well, in a court case, we would be able to show this is our land. And then you can free up members of your family to go to the city and take better opportunities. So that's just one example. I'm sure there's others. It's a huge area, I think, of research that needs to be done. There is a lot of research on land titling and land market failures. Recently, Diego Restuccia and co-authors in the macro literature have been thinking about that. So information frictions, to answer your question, and land market frictions, these are big frictions that hold back migration and could hold back people's incomes.
Is there a role for incentives to migrate as well for policymakers?
I think the things I describe, the land market things, are disincentives for sure. Do we need to incentivize migration? That one, I don't know. I guess if there were big externalities where getting everybody in the city together, you know, there's agglomeration externalities, urban economists, you know, always talking about agglomeration externalities. I'm not sure how much of that comes through uneducated people moving from villages. If workers are mostly just crowding cities, I doubt that you'd be wanting to incentivize them. Politically, I just don't smell any low-income country wanting to incentivize financially moving to cities. I think they view they're already being too much. I mean, they're probably wrong, but I think that's the attitudes that I perceive, is that they don't want to induce any more migration.
So, David, considering that we started this by saying how important it is to think about this, is there anything that policymakers could do, a missed opportunity that you see from all your research at the moment that you would like to see more of them taking up?
I don't know if there's any low-hanging fruit. I think that information types in other settings have said, hey, things as cheap as sending a text message can get big results in getting farmers to plant more efficiently or use more inputs. Maybe in this migration setting, information is a kind of a quick fix. I think the jury is really out on that. I think the long run stuff, you know, the kind of bread and butter development issues of fixing education systems, having land titling systems, I think these are going to pay off in the long run. So I think policymakers were listening to me, which they're probably not. That's what I would tell them, to focus on those long run bread and butter issues that are going to give opportunities for people to take their human capital and their physical capital and move those to cities where those might be more productive.
David, all policymakers listen to Vox Dev Talk, so you will be getting contacted by them very shortly. Thank you very much for talking to me today, though.
Thanks so much, Tim. It's been great.
There's a lot of information in David's paper that we don't have the time to discuss, so read it and then read the papers it references too. David's referred to a few of them today. There are many more mentioned in the article, and I've been having a look at some of them, and it is very, very interesting about what we know and also what we don't know. The paper's called Urban-Rural Gaps in a Developing World. Does Internal Migration Offer Opportunities? Author, of course, David Lagalkos, and the publication is the Journal of Economic Perspectives, 34.3. That's a 2020 publication. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform, and you can find us on all the popular platforms these days, so don't miss an episode. Or look up the past episodes at voxdev.org.